This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Mark Haney.
Call me Ishmael. Some years ago, never mind how long, I thought that I would sail about a little and see the watery part of the world. Whenever I grow grim about the mouth and hazy in the eyes, whenever it's a damp November in my soul, I count it time to get to sea. Almost all men, sometime or other, cherish these same feelings toward the ocean.
That was Orson Welles' great voice reciting the first lines from Herman Melville's classic novel Moby Dick. Many have loved reading the books, others painfully slogged their way through it, and some of us just saw the movie. It's been called the American Bible, and it comes alive this weekend with the Moby Dick Art Fest. The 4 days of events kick off this evening and include a symposium, panel discussion, a marathon reading of the novel, and an exhibit of artworks inspired by the novel created by Northern Kentucky University students over the past two decades. Here to tell us more about the events and to discuss why Moby Dick remains one of the great American novels are Dr. Bob Wallace, NKU Regents Professor, and one of the world's preeminent experts on Herman Melville and Moby Dick, Caitlin Sparks, an artist with Numediacy, who has three pieces in the art exhibit, and Emma Rose Thompson, an NKU art history major. She designed the exhibit catalog and has been an equal partner in planning all the Arts Fest events. And good afternoon, everybody. Good to see all of you. Bob, tell me why Moby Dick is referred to as the American Bible.
Well, it keeps speaking like the Bible does with new meanings to every generation. I find that in teaching. We see it in the broader culture. And I've read it many, many times and taught it a lot of times, and it's always a different experience. And new generations of students respond differently. Starting with Call Me Ishmael, that opening sentence was generally interpreted from a Judeo-Christian point of view, where Ishmael is the scapegoat and the outcast in the in that Bible, but he is one of the founders of Islam. So when the book is read now by people trying to think of how Christians and Islamic people can get together, or when it's read by teachers and taught by teachers I know in Iran and in Algeria, it's a really rich book from that point of view, because here's a very famous opening sentence that people thought they knew what it meant, but it's really an invitation to multicultural understanding. And that is really, I think, the ultimate worth of the book to us today, as we live in a global society and try to learn with other, to live with other races and peoples, because the sailors on the ship didn't choose to be together, but by accident they ended up representing all these different nations, and they had to find a way to get along. And Melville was very attuned to the difficulties of cross-cultural communication, but also the richness. So from that point of view, the book gets deeper and deeper every time.
So what are some of the other things, Bob, that make this such a great novel?
Well, another thing that's been particularly strong in the last 30 years is the ecological consciousness of the novel. If you read the movie, you think it's about killing whales. But if you read the book, it's about knowing whales and understanding them and understanding the broader human ecology, or the natural ecology, that we're all a part of. Melville did not give sermons in that way in the novel, but he was very attuned to that. In one chapter, he asked, will the whale perish? Are we going to kill this creature out of existence as we did with the buffalo? And all these chapters about the eyes of the whale and the skeleton, the brain, how he thinks, which seem to be digressions if you're reading the novel just for the plot, are really important. So one really great example, I think, that touches a lot of angles of interpretation is this chapter on the sperm whale's head. And Ishmael, the narrator, notes that the sperm whale's eyes are on the opposite sides of his head, and he can't see what's in front of him. So like the best way to come at him maybe is through the forehead, except you might get smashed if you do that. But the point is that he makes is the whale must have a really sophisticated brain that he can see out of both eyes at the same time and somehow make something whole out of that. And he suggests that we use that as an analogy for how we need to be as human beings to see multiple points of view. So almost every chapter has surprising analogies of that kind, which really have a lot to do with living well with other humans and other creatures in the world.
Now, Emma, you've taken Dr. Wallace's course on Moby Dick at NKU. What's your take on the novel?
The novel for me was pretty difficult to read since it's written much differently than contemporary fiction, which is what I was used to, and that's why I took the course. So actually reading the book itself was very difficult, but there's so much that you can glean from it, even from an outsider's perspective. There's something for everyone in it. And really, where I became fascinated with the book was through my classmates' interpretations of it. So I guess my take on it is that it speaks to everyone, and it is very universal, just like the Bible. So I would agree with Dr. Wallace.
Even in the younger generation, it still speaks to you.
Absolutely. Yeah.
Caitlin, what about you? You took the course as well. What's your take on Moby Dick?
Well, I totally agree with these two, that people from all different backgrounds can approach this novel and take something away from it. I was particularly drawn to the environmental relevance of the novel. I think, it made me think about our vision of nature and our interaction with it. And, you know, like, in the novel, Ahab is, like, driving his crew closer and closer to danger for his conquest. He needs to kill this whale. It's his like destiny. So as I was reading this novel, I see this kind of authority over nature happening all around us and in big industries of today.
Bob, didn't the book struggle commercially? It fell out of print around the time of Melville's death.
Yes, the book really fell out of popular consciousness within 3 or 4 years. And so he lived another 40 years thinking the book was a failure. And it really didn't start being revived until by a few people in the 1920s and then some university classes in the 40s. And then in the 50s and 60s, it started to become considered a great American novel. So some of these issues that are so important to us today about the ecology and Ahab is a very successful demagogue. And after Hitler and Stalin, their period during Second World War, people were starting to see that the novel was important from that point of view in showing what a tyrannical leader can do to lead people in the wrong direction. So, you know, that isn't something people would have thought of necessarily in Melville's time. So, once it came back, it's been very thoroughly read. However, it's read in different ways because in the 70s, when the feminist point of view came along and offered really great critiques of what was the old canon, which was all dead white males, you may remember hearing that term in the 70s, people try to suggest that Melville's book was irrelevant because it was a man's book. But it has concerns, critiques of what you could call the male patriarchal society and critiques of the post-colonial world that uses third world peoples at their expense for its own profit. It has critiques of that kind, which became more and more central to our understanding of where our world needed to go in the second half of the 20th and now 21st century. So these new elements of the book came forward as really society needed it. And it's kind of amazing that Melville could see these deeper dynamics. It's a post-colonial novel, for example, right at the time when America and Europeans were becoming colonial countries and starting to overtake parts of the world. Melville saw that start, and he saw that in many ways it was unhealthy. He had a lot of appreciation for the integrity of other peoples who we were trying to get to think our way and for the lives of the animals we were killing for our own profit and just leaving floating on the ocean. There are terrible, you know, images there of when they strip the whale and just leave the white body out there. It's an amazing ecological image for our time today. But, you know, other people weren't worrying about that then. They just left the garbage on the ocean.
So it sounds like this book is still relevant even today, even in the 21st century. Emma, you're shaking your head. You see it that way?
Yes, and actually tonight I will be one of four speakers to talk about how it's still relevant in the 21st century. And what I'm going to do in my talk is discuss some of the artists from our show and in our catalog and how in the 21st century they're connecting with this novel.
Caitlin, what about you? I mean, you see this as still being very relevant even today. You were talking about the ecological themes earlier. Those are definitely still relevant, aren't they?
Absolutely. One of the photo series that I created was it's called The Whale, and it was to bring attention to the whale character. Throughout the novel, he's often described as like a monster, a vicious monster, and Ahab himself even believed that the whale was like pure evil. So they were always after this creature and kind of ferociously. So in the photo series that I made, they're self-portraits. They're much softer. They're describing this creature as something beautiful. So, you know, I was trying to bring attention to like this misconception that they have of the creature. They think it's evil. But while I was reading the whole novel, I always sided with the whale. I always felt for the whale. So, yeah, I think environmentally, it's definitely still relevant.
Is that common, Bob? Do people usually side with the whale?
These days, almost all the students side with the whale. I mean, it's been a total change. That was not true when I started teaching in the 70s. But a lot of new things happened. Like in the 80s, students became concerned about Ishmael and Queequeg being in bed together in Chapter 3, and it's a little suggestive the way Melville describes it. And they really wanted to know if anything was happening between them. You know, they were worried about it. By the late 90s, people are just embracing that situation as natural. I mean, it was so interesting how the consciousness changed that way. And as far as the whale that is probably the hero of the book for most readers now, and Queequeg is next, the great tattooed Polynesian who's just an upstanding, fantastic human being. And Pip, the black cabin boy, is a very emotive character who we care about a great deal now, where that was not true at the time the book was written. And what's interesting about teaching this course is that every student kind of makes the book their own. Melville starts a book saying, "Call me Ishmael." He's inviting us to be actively involved in reading the book. And it's a big challenge because he throws everything at us. But what I found, one reason I enjoy teaching the novel is that it does invite the reader to be active. So I now teach the novel itself by having students keep a log, and we read 10 segments of the book in a row, and they have to write in their journal their response to each segment of reading, and that gets them to actively get involved with the book. And there's so many different ways to get involved. So the thing that's interesting about this course and in my experience through it is that I had a student in 1994 who was an art major, and I used to require English research papers like every English teacher does. And Fred North said, "Well, I'm an art major. Can I make a painting instead of writing one of those research papers?" So he was a great student, and I trusted him with that. And he did two beautiful paintings as his final project. So I made that option available now to all students. So most students these days are siding with the whale, and a majority of students are choosing to do artworks rather than the research paper as their final project, even if they've never made one before. I have some art majors like Caitlin and some art history majors like Emma Rose, and then there are a lot of English students and honors students who are trying it for the first time. And there's something about Moby Dick which allows every reader to find some creative way into it, so that the most exciting part for me in the course is always the last 2 weeks when they make their final presentations. And some people still do research papers, which are great, but creating an artwork out of yourself in response to something that moved you in the work has been moving for students and for me as a teacher. So it's really exciting to have, we've got 105 works by 53 students over a 20-year period at the show in Covington. And it will be there from now until May 15th. But when we have the marathon reading of the novel on Saturday and Sunday, will be there in the exhibition space. So people can sign up to read 10 minutes from the novel, and you can do that on the website, mobydick.nku.edu. If you go to that website and see where the marathon is, you can click on and choose a 10-minute period. So we're going to have a really wonderful mixture of the art and the novel going on at the same time this weekend.
Caitlin, tell me about the other art pieces that you're going to have in this exhibit. You mentioned one of them, but you've got two others as
well. Two others, yeah. And they're sets of photographs, so there's multiple photographs in each series. The other one is titled Ahab, and they're framed in old window transoms, and the windows are kind of beat up. I used myself to describe Ahab. You know, he's this angry male character who I don't particularly relate with, but I chose, you know, myself because I feel like I am also capable of that sort of obsession and conquest. And, you know, I feel like we all are. I also chose like a female form to describe him because there's a side of Ahab that is not seen too often in the story, and that's his wife and his child who are waiting for him back on shore. So in the Ahab series, this figure is kind of waiting, and she's damaged, and she's like the other half of Ahab. And then the other set I titled the Insanity series. And, you know, as I mentioned, like, Ahab's driving this crew into, like, an imminent doom. And, you know, I'm just thinking about how this kind of parallels with things that are happening today, and it's something that kind of drives me to a little bit of insanity and just... You know, so I'm feeling this kind of strangeness and scariness, and that's what that piece is about.
Emma, Bob was saying 105 pieces of artwork and all in this. How did you go about pulling all this together?
Well, a lot of the work Dr. Wallace owns himself, and mm-hmm. then some of the artists like Caitlin and Kathleen Piercefield and Carla Bell, they're all local, and we were able to get some of their artwork from them or from collectors. So we kind of already had it, and some of the rest was not that hard to get. Do you want me to talk a little bit about
sure.
the exhibition itself?
Go right
I guess
ahead.
How we got. We were originally thinking a gallery space, and
but it ended up in the public library.
Yes,
right?
It ended up in the library, which was perfect because they let us put artwork wherever we wanted on all three floors. So they have some tracking system, and we have some kind of traditionally hung work. But they let us hang things from the staircase. They let us put things in their rock garden. We were allowed to completely flood the whole place with artwork, which was a really cool experience because that's kind of how the book is. It just kind of throws itself at you, and you're immersed in it, and you just have to take what you can from it. There's so much work, there's no way you're going to remember every piece, but there's... Again, something for everyone. There's such a wide range of work. We have quilts, we have paintings, we have photographs. You name it, it's probably in the exhibition.
Sounds like it. Now, Bob, Emma was mentioning there's a panel discussion that starts things off this evening. Can you tell us some more about that?
Yes. We're going to have four speakers, and the first one is Elizabeth Schultz from University of Kansas. She wrote Unpainted to the Last, which is the Bible of Moby Dick and American art. Until she wrote this book in 1995, nobody had any idea how much work had been done by creative artists in response to the novel for a whole century. Now, in the 20 years since, there's been just as much done, so her book has become the Old Testament. And we have the New Testament, which she's going to be talking about Monday in the symposium at Northern, what's happened since her book was done in the visual arts. But our focus tonight at the Art Museum will be on how does a 19th century novel speak to the 21st century. So she is a great ecologist and a poet as well as a literary scholar, and she will be giving her answer to exactly your question, why do people read Moby Dick today? Our second speaker is Matt Kish, who lives in Dayton, and he's written probably the strongest created the strongest art project we have right now on Moby Dick. It's a book called Moby Dick in Pictures, one drawing for every page. His edition had 522 pages. He did one for every page every day, And he did this while working at the Dayton Metropolitan Library. This guy's a Clark Kent who's a real Superman. And he's going to be speaking about how he created that book. But he's also, he is going to be have a two-man show with Robert Del Tredici, a two-man Moby Dick show at Cincinnati's Contemporary Arts Center in 2016. That'll be announced soon with their new season. So he finished that huge project, and now he's going on to, he's going to do all the whales in the cetology chapter, and it'll be amazing. So then our, but he'll be talking too about why the book speaks to the broader culture, not only to artists. The third is Sam Otter, who is a Melville Scholar at University of California, Berkeley, and he is editor of the Melville Society Journal, Leviathan, so he's the world's top editor. So these are really the world's three top people in their field right now, editing Melville, creating Moby Dick artwork, and interpreting artwork. And our fourth will be Emma Rose.
Of course, Emma.
Who's going to talk about her experience. So it should be a very lively and fascinating discussion. So everyone, the four speakers will speak. They'll make an opening statement for 10 to 15 minutes, and then we'll have an open-ended discussion, a lot of questions from the audience. So we're very excited about starting the whole weekend there at the Art Museum.
And there's an all-day symposium on Monday, right?
Right. Yeah. And on Monday, Beth Schultz will give that, what you call the New Testament of Moby Dick and the Arts, and that'll be a 50-minute talk that is the first test of the talk she'll give in Tokyo to the International Melville Society. She's giving the plenary speech at that international conference, and we'll be hearing it first. She'll give it there. Sam Otter and a scholar from Michigan are going to give closing remarks at the end of the day, and in between we've got two panel discussions where our guest speakers are going to be talking with NKU students who've created art in my class. So we're going to have Matt Kish and five NKU student artists talking about creating Moby Dick art in the morning, and then at 1 o'clock in the afternoon, we will have a pedagogical session where a great teacher, Jeff Markham from New Trier High School near Chicago, has his high school students do a year-long Moby Dick project every other year. So he'll be talking about that. We have Don Dingeldine from Wisconsin, who does Moby Dick and the Arts in his class, and again, four of my students talking about their experience, either from the interpretive angle where they're in the class, or some of them have been teaching since. So it's going to be very exciting to have all these people coming together. And then we'll have a reception to complete the whole thing Monday night back at the public library in Covington to honor the student artists as well as the special guests.
And, of course, sandwiched in between all this is the marathon reading.
That's right.
Really like to see that. How many people do you think you're going to have for that?
Well, the novel takes about 24 hours to read out loud, and we're doing it from 9 in the morning till 9 in the evening on both Saturday and Sunday. And we're inviting people to sign up for 10 minutes at a time. So if you count that out, you've got about 144 different readers. We're about halfway full right now. Some people are saying, can I read more than 10 minutes? Well, you're going to be able to if there's some blanks after you. But we're trying to have people do the 10 minutes to start with so that we get as many readers as possible. So I'm guessing we'll have about 100 different readers, and then a few people get to double up.
Caitlin and Emma, are you taking part in the marathon reading?
Yes.
Yeah, definitely.
Yeah, I signed
Wouldn't
up.
Miss it, right?
I signed up for the first slot so that I knew what I was reading.
What about you, Caitlin? Do you know how far down the line you are?
I'm not 100% sure.
Not 100% sure.
Caitlin is actually part of a art collaborative with Jay Gray. They call themselves New Mediacy, and they have they're in a group show at the Weston Gallery about the environment, the water, the future of water, at the Aronoff Center right now. It's their first big show in Cincinnati. And they are also going to be covering this four-day arts fest for us. So that's one reason she won't be at the microphone. She and Jay are going to be creeping around trying to get some good stuff. And we also have a videographer from Michigan who's coming down, David Scharf, who came down a month ago to case it out. He's been on a 5-year project to document the relevance of Moby Dick in the 21st century. He hopes it would be an hour-long PBS special at some point. He's near the end. He's going to come down and film the whole 4 days also. So We're going to have a lot of people around. It will be a three-ring circus for sure.
Well, Bob, Caitlin, and Emma, thank you so much for joining us this afternoon. Dr. Bob Wallace, NKU Regents Professor and one of the world's preeminent experts on Herman Melville and Moby Dick. Caitlin Sparks, an artist with Numediacy, who has three pieces in the art exhibit. And Emma Rose Thompson, an NKU art history major. She designed the exhibition catalog and has been an equal partner in planning all Arts Fest's events.